Hi, I'm Roy Spencer of PermaSeal. For over 45 years, we've helped over 500,000 homeowners make their homes drier, healthier, and more valuable. Our warranties are transferable and estimates are free. Call 800-421-SEAL or visit permaseal.net.
Our regular Damon Sharonis, one of the best criminal defense lawyers in Chicago. If I ever did anything really bad, I would call him really fast. A founder of Sharonis and Parente, he's a fierce advocate for people charged with federal, white-collar, violent crimes, drug and sex crimes. He's been involved in some of the highest-profile cases across the country, including that of Harvey Weinstein. Damon, thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Karen. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. I'm glad you stepped away from your NASCAR, and you're here with us today.
I'm in my office.
You're in your office. Oh, that's the glamorous life of a lawyer, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay, so on Wednesday, we had a verdict in the sex trafficking case. It was a divided verdict, not guilty on the serious charges of racketeering and sex trafficking, and guilty on two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution. When you saw this verdict, Damon, did you say victory for Combs?
Oh, like Super Bowl, World Series, whatever, huge victory. It doesn't get much bigger than this for a defendant charged the way he was charged.
And, you know, when you see a split verdict like this, you know, again, we're speculating because we haven't really listened to everything the jurors have said so far. But what do you make of what the jurors found or didn't find to be compelling given the way this verdict came down?
Yeah, I mean, I think they just rejected the charges that were, you know, the easiest ones to reject. I mean, a racketeering case, you know, they have a high level of success when they're brought properly because the government's allowed to bring in all different types of evidence, proof of all different types of criminal activity spanning years, sometimes decades. So juries get overwhelmed. But here, I think the jury just rejected the fact that this was a criminal enterprise. You know, there was no structure here. It wasn't your typical criminal enterprise like a drug trafficking organization or a Chicago outfit. So I think they just saw this for what it was, at least as it pertains to the racketeering charge, and just wasn't racketeering. You know, that was the most serious charge. But the sex trafficking charges were just as serious because if you went down on those, he was looking at a 15-year mandatory minimum. So for those, I think they rejected, you know, a lot of the witnesses' testimony.
And is it fair to say that as to racketeering, I mean, we used to use those types of charges for, like you say, the mob or a gang-related enterprise where there was some sort of structure, almost like a little company that was committing crimes. And we saw it used in the R. Kelly case, and it was successful in that case. You just don't think that this was as structured as it needed to be in order to get that charge?
Well, I think with this, they charge what's called an association in fact enterprise, a bunch of people who are associated, not maybe under sort of a legal umbrella, but in fact working together for the same thing. In the R. Kelly case, at least they had other co-defendants, at least they had other people testify who were sort of part of this alleged enterprise. And whether they were right in that case or not, I don't know. But in this case, from what I read, they didn't even have, like, insiders testify for the most part. There were no co-defendants. You know, I think the jury just saw this as maybe a depraved way to live and some ridiculous parties, but did not, you know, fit the bill for an actual criminal enterprise. And I think they got it right, and good for them, right? They weren't there to judge whether or not they agreed with, you know, how this guy lives his life or whether he was a bad person. They followed the law.
And, you know, as much as we all saw that videotape of Combs brutally kicking and beating his beautiful girlfriend, that wasn't part of the charges. That was domestic violence and battery were not part of those charges, although I would imagine that impacted the jury and they didn't like that. But again, they probably looked at those jury instructions and followed them pretty carefully to get this verdict, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that video was probably what started this whole case. I think the U.S. Attorney's Office probably took a look at that and then tried to build the case out from there. And what it showed was a serious felony aggravated battery, a horrible crime that he was never charged with and he can't be anymore because of the statute of limitations. But again, while that may have corroborated some of their arguments as to his control and coercion, it just was what it was, a very horrible act that does not a federal criminal conviction make, I guess.
And this is kind of a touchy thing because I'm pretty strong advocate for women, and I have represented a lot of domestic violence victims as well as perpetrators, I will tell you. And there was some idea, and the prosecution, I think, did a good job from what I could see, of not victim blaming, but saying, hey, listen, these women volunteered to do this. They, you know, it's even hard for me to say it, but, you know, they agreed to show up. They agreed to take the drugs. They agreed to come back after it happened once, twice, three times. They wrote him notes saying they're looking forward to the next time. They wanted something from him. They were bound to him. Do you think that that was difficult for the jury to understand? And I'm asking you this in the context of you having represented Harvey Weinstein, because I think those were some of the same arguments that the defense made there.
Sure. I mean, that as a defense attorney, you look for objective evidence to show consent, objective evidence to show that the relationship was not one based on power and coercion. In this case, again, from what I've read, they had all that. They had all of these text messages and emails and things that made it appear, at least, that a lot of the individuals involved were not being forced, were not being coerced. In the Weinstein case, we had, you know, bucket loads of that type of evidence to establish what we thought was a strong defense of consent. And, you know, it really, really, really comes down to the jury that you pick and how they are going to interpret that type of evidence. And what I tell, the way I look at cases where you have that type of evidence, I'm very comfortable saying I don't know what actually happened, but if I have this type of evidence, it would be difficult for me to enter a guilty verdict. Doesn't mean nothing happened, but my job is to look at the law, look at the evidence. Now, I know there was some expert testimony in our case, and I know there was also some in the Combs case, and the government will oftentimes call experts to try to explain how individuals will continue to, you know, keep in touch with their abusers. And that's all legitimate. That happens. And I think they did that in this case, but I don't know how effective that was based on all of the other evidence they saw.
And you see these sort of trends, and, you know, like with Weinstein, you know, he was the guy. If you wanted to be famous and if you wanted to get into movies, you know, he was a really good avenue there. And R. Kelly, I mean, he took advantage of these young girls who wanted to break into whatever music scene or what have you. And, you know, he took advantage of that and used his power and his influence to can exert his sexual preferences on them. But again, at what point do you as a human being have a duty to say no to something, right? And again, I get it. I get brainwashing. I get domestic violence. I get that you don't think you have an option to get out. I'm not saying that I don't understand that, but it's just really hard, I think, for a jury to really get the idea that you don't have free will in a case like this.
I couldn't agree more. And you got to remember the standard that we're dealing with, right? We're dealing with proof beyond a reasonable doubt. We're dealing with the standard of Combs, Weinstein, R. Kelly. They're all presumed innocent. And those things, you know, mean something. In other words, you know, you don't start out 50-50 on an even playing field. The government charges people. They have the highest burden that one can ask for in the criminal justice system. And if it's a close call, if it's maybe he did it, if it's he probably did it, it's not guilty. I mean, that's just the way it is. So, you know, that's another thing that gets baked into this, that the jurors who follow the law, you know, a good juror could actually say to themselves, I think he may have done it. I think he may be guilty, but the evidence just isn't sufficient beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that probably happened in this case, and it probably happens in a lot of other cases.
Yeah, and you even hear jurors say, like, I wish I could have convicted him. I couldn't do it, given the jury instructions. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but I think it was like just the day before the verdict came down, the jury foreperson came out and said to the judge, listen, there's a juror here, juror number 25 or something, tells us that he won't or he can't apply the jury instructions. And that was a concern. Have you ever seen anyone come out and say, hey, I can't apply these jury instructions? What do you make of something like that?
So normally that comes out in jury selection. And oftentimes it's people who want to get off of a jury. They say, I don't think I can follow the law. I don't think in my career, and I've tried, you know, got more juries than I could think of, where a juror came out and said, I can't follow the law as it has been instructed. Now, I'm sure what happens in, you know, I think it probably happens more than we know. This just sort of came out and they talked about it. So, you know, in a situation like that, as a defense attorney, you're very nervous that the judge is going to throw that juror off, right? Because, you know, sometimes you might be thinking, well, it's good for my client that they're not going to follow the law, because the jury instructions are oftentimes not drafted in a way to help a criminal defendant. But it seems like they went back to work and that sort of was, you know, taken care of.
Yeah. And, you know, with the words jury nullification were being floated around the media, the idea is that this guy got on with an agenda to acquit or convict. I'm not quite sure, you know, maybe acquit,
yeah,
and was just going to say, I don't care what the facts are, I don't care what the law is, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, which, again, would be dishonoring his oath. And he maybe wised up and decided to just abandon that that strategy there.
Yeah. And we don't know, because we don't have it. I would love to have an ear inside a jury room. How great would that be?
It would be so great to watch that.
Yeah.
So Combs faces 20 years, 10 for each count of prostitution, transportation for the purpose of prostitution. As a practical matter, and again, you practiced in New York for the Weinstein case, so you might know a little bit about sentencing. But, you know, even just apply what you know about judges, federal judges in the Chicago area. Are we looking at 20 years? Are we looking at something like 5 years?
So the way it looks is, as you know, you got to go through the federal sentencing guidelines. It's my understanding, just from what I've read and talked to some colleagues about, that his guideline range is like 24 months. Right. So we're not talking about, just because the maximum is 10 years, people rarely get the maximum. So if he has a guideline range of 24 months, I believe the government said at the bond hearing when he tried to get out after he was convicted that they were going to be seeking about 5 years. Right. So the sentencing is going to be, you know, a passion play on both parts. The government is going to want to get some kind of credit for all of the bad things they showed about Mr. Combs that he was acquitted on. And a judge can take some of that into account at a sentencing. And the defense is going to put forward all of the good things he did, because regardless of what came out at trial, I'm sure there's a lot of good to the things he's done in his life and people he's helped. So at the end of the day, the judge is going to have a guideline range, and they're going to decide whether to sentence him within that range or above that range. I think it will probably be somewhere between 2 and 5 years. I do not see him getting time served, although, you know, based on the counts of conviction, that would not be unreasonable.
Yeah, I mean, just having seen those kinds of cases float around our federal courts, if it were anyone else, you would be surprised if it were that many years. We're talking to lawyer Damon Chironis about the two big criminal cases that came to resolution this very week. We finished talking about Sean Combs, and now I want to turn our attention to the Idaho murder plea deal. A former criminal justice doctoral student was charged in the murders of four University of Idaho students in 2022. This week, he admitted to the crimes in court before formally entering a guilty plea in exchange for life in prison without the possibility of parole. He waived all rights to appeal. Damon, from what you see, again, we don't know everything from the media accounts, but it seemed to happen very quickly and without a lot of notice to the victims' families, who have complained a little bit about this, and we're going to talk about the plea itself. But the timing, why did this happen so quickly?
You know, it could have been in the works for longer than, you know, we are aware. But, you know, on the other end, a vast majority of plea agreements, you know, after cases get set for trial, it is not unusual for these rapidly moving plea agreements to just occur. You know, parties are prepping for trial. They see something. A defendant gets cold feet. He decides, in this case, he doesn't, you know, want to die in prison. You know, it's not unusual for cases to end quickly.
And, you know, I think I saw that the defense, as they are supposed to do, advocating for their clients zealously, is, you know, they lodged a lot of different motions to exclude evidence. You know, they wanted to get the death penalty dropped because he was on the spectrum. They wanted to get certain evidence excluded. And one by one, those motions, it seemed, were all getting denied. And I suppose that when you run to the end of those, and you realize that you're not going to get any of the relief you wanted, and you see what's staring at you, I suppose that's when you turn and say, all right, let's cut a deal, right?
Yeah, I mean, the only, I believe it was life or death with him, right? I mean, I think that,
yep.
If I understand it correctly, you know, and oftentimes with the evidence overwhelmingly against you, he may have come to the conclusion that, you know, I would rather die in prison, you know, 50 years from now than die by lethal injection. And you know, the state did not have to necessarily entertain that agreement, but they decided to.
And, you know, and I remember that they just finished building their new firing squad chamber. So it may have been a firing squad, instead of a lethal injection, which they say that's less painful than the lethal injection, but still not something you would look forward to. So,
No. You
know, a lot of the family members expressed some anger that they were not told about the plea deal. What rights do victims have when it comes to this kind of thing, Damon? And what are the prosecutors' legal obligations, and what are the prosecutors' moral obligations, in your view, when they cut a deal like this?
Well, I can just say in Chicago, it doesn't have to be a case like this for the victims to get involved. You know, in any case where you have a crime of violence or a financial crime in both state and federal court, you know, the victims are always consulted, certainly in state court, and I'm assuming in federal court as well. You know, it doesn't come up quite as much. You know, in state court, you're trying to resolve a case, and like, well, look, I gotta talk to the victim. So, you know, there have been times where alleged victims in cases have essentially, you know, put the kibosh on a resolution because they don't go along with it. So I think in a case like this, it is shocking that the victims' families were not much more involved in this. I mean, we're talking about one of the most horrific crimes this country has seen, and that's saying something. Just nightmarish. These young women were killed for no reason, and their families' lives have been forever, you know, ruined by that to some extent, and to not have like daily contact with the prosecutors and know everything that's going on is very surprising.
And, you know, even if the victim said, hey, listen, we want death, nothing is going to satisfy us. You know, again, there's numerous families and there's numerous family members. So my guess is that there were some people, and I think I remember reading that, who were against the death penalty. They wanted, sure, just put them in jail, lock them up. It's more punishment to throw them there, and then we're done, and we have closure and finality, you know. And some of them were saying, no, you know, we want death. You know, the prosecutors have to listen, and the prosecutors should consider the victim's family's wishes, but they have other obligations to consider other things, do they not?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want, you know, don't mistake what I said for that the families have the final say. But oftentimes, you know, they do carry a lot of sway with prosecutors on how cases are going to get resolved. But at the end of the day, it is absolutely up to the prosecutor's office to decide, you know, how to finalize a case. But there's a way to do it. You know, there's a way to get the family together in a room and say, look, this is what's on the table, and we understand your position, but we think this is, you know, best for the state, best for everyone. You know, he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. That's not easy to do. You know, it just sounds like it could have been handled a little bit more professionally and a little more, you know, empathetically.
And, you know, we see this optics, as we say, you know, it's so important. And this is now no serious comparison, but the Jussie Smollett case was one where I just thought to myself, you know what, the deal was cut, and the deal probably wasn't something out of the ordinary to cut a deal with Smollett for this disorderly conduct. But the way it was done so quickly and without notice, and it was a done deal before anyone knew about it, I think the optics of that were so bad that it's not the substance of it, but it's the way it looked.
Oh, absolutely, especially when you have, you know, elected state attorneys, and, you know, they're always very, very mindful of how things are going to look, and they should be, because they want to be reelected. Sometimes, you know, the optics overtake the substance, which I think is problematic. You know, you've got to take into account a lot of things other than what just a victim's family or a victim thinks. But no, I think in this case, it's kind of hard to screw this one up, though. I mean, this is a internationally covered case. There's documentaries about it. You know, it's everyone's nightmare. And, you know, to not proceed with kid gloves with these family members a little bit more, I think is just odd, for lack of a better term.
Absolutely. And a lot of people are saying motive. What was this guy's motive? Was he there to commit the perfect crime? You know, he was studying crime. Some of his friends or colleagues in school were opining about what might be the motive. We don't know what the motive is. Is there any way, and I've been asked this before, is there any way to make him talk about what the motive was as part of the plea deal, or is there no way to do that?
I always try to get in a Bruce Springsteen quote. At the end of the song Nebraska, he said, "Sir, I guess there's just a meanness in this world." And I think that's appropriate for this guy. I think he's evil. I think he's a sociopath. What could the motive be other than, you know, he's just an evil person who did an evil thing? To answer the question more sort of substantively, you can't force him to say what his motive was. I mean, what he did, right? No, you might not want to accept this, is he accepted responsibility for the criminal acts. You know, he pled guilty. He said, "I did this." And I don't think a motive would satisfy anybody. It would probably enrage people more. I don't think he knew who these people were. So, you know, I think that the sort of, you know, voyeuristic, you know, ideas of everybody, we want to know more, we want to know everything. But at the end of the day, this was a senseless, horrible, brutal crime. And, you know, he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. I know there have been sort of plea agreements in other cases where, hey, if you show us sort of where the body is, yep, you know, we're going to take death off the table. So there are situations like that. But for his motive, I think it would have been, if anything, more enraging, because there probably was no motive.
And one last question, Damon, before I let you go back to your criminal defense preparation for your Monday. You've been in prisons all over, and I've been in a few myself.
As a lawyer only.
How does someone like this defendant, this convicted defendant, survive in prison? I mean, he's a young man, he's white, he's not your typical prisoner in these kinds of prisons, generally speaking. What do they do to protect him? How is he going to fare in prison? Just so you know, just give us a little bird's eye view of it.
You know, for your average person convicted of murder in Illinois, you know, you go to Menards, you go to a super max horrible prison. Somebody like this, though, would very likely be in the special housing unit or somewhere where he can have some form of protection. You know, when you have high profile defendants who are charged with these cases, I think Drew Peterson was in one for a while. You know, they become targets. So whatever his life is going to look like, as long as it's going to be, it's not going to be fun. It's not going to be happy. He's going to get a very small window of freedom, which just basically means probably getting out of his cell for an hour or two a day, if even that. But no, he is most likely going to be in a special housing unit for sort of high profile defendants. And, you know, he will have some life. You know, he'll be able to do certain things. He's going to be alive. He's going to be breathing air, which I think some people, you know, these family members would object to. But it's not going to be any type of real existence.
Absolutely. Damon Chironas, thank you so much for joining us and explaining these things. As always, how would someone get in touch with you?
My name, you can just Google my name or put in Chironas Law. That'll lead you to my website. And I'm trying to get an appeal done right now, so I won't call you back today.
Okay. Well, good luck on your appeal, and thanks for taking the time.